listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Check out Ear to the Streets of Portland with hosts Sequoina
and Kayla
every first and third Thursday of the month starting at 7 o'clock p.m.
Listen in as we interview community organizers, speak on issues focused on Black Portland, and share community events happening in the area and elsewhere.
Listen on the radio at 90.7 FM, online at www.kboo.fm, or from your mobile phone at m.kboo.fm.
Follow KBOO on Instagram at KBOO Radio. Ear to the Streets.
Did you know that KBOO is streaming live on the web? Well, you do now. Just type www.kboo.fm, click on Listen Live, and you've got us. Just another example of how KBOO 90.7 FM Portland works for you. It's your community radio.
This is Sun Lee. I'm the host of the Grateful Dead and Friends show every second Saturday of the month from noon to 2 p.m. Been a part of this amazing collective of music lovers for around 15 years. Not exactly sure when I started. I do know that we are celebrating the 20th anniversary of the show being aired on KBOO. And to celebrate, we'd like to raise $10,000 for the station in order to purchase the studio transmitter link, a vital piece of equipment that KBOO needs to get sound to listeners. If you are able, please consider donating today. You can visit kboo.fm/grateful, or you can text from your phone GDAF to 44321. That's GDAF to 44321, or go to kboo.fm/grateful. I also want to thank you in advance for your support for the show over the last 20 years. Our listeners and members are an amazing group of humans, and without you, this show would not be possible.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, the interrelationship between economic and environmental justice in the time of COVID-19. On March 11th, 2020, the World Health Organization officially declared COVID-19 a pandemic. Since then, we've seen vulnerable communities around the world, both in the global north and global south, suffer the most. Before COVID-19 began wreaking havoc on people around the world, the effects of environmental devastation and poverty meant that billions of people were already experiencing untold hardships. Now, as the coronavirus pandemic impacts people in all corners of the planet, it has become more obvious that those who are most vulnerable bear the heaviest burden. The COVID-19 pandemic has exposed and reinforced the cruelty of economic, social, and political systems, which push billions of people into poverty and is destroying Mother Earth as we speak. In light of this, there are growing pressures from movements around the world for systemic change. Among those demands are a call for a global Green New Deal, which its proponents say will move us from crisis to justice for people and the planet. In the coming weeks, groups like The Leap and The War on Want will be launching a call to action for a global Green New Deal. Thus far, their three core demands are: 1, end global inequality by uplifting workers' rights; 2, reclaim and redistribute the global commons; 3, rebuild global finance and trade regimes. What they have not yet included, however, is the call initiated by the Green New Deal for Europe and then taken up by the Global Women's Strike for a care income for those who care for children, the elderly, those with disabilities, and the earth. The Global Women's Strike had long been calling for a living wage for all, including mothers and other caregivers. Today, you will hear audio from the recent webinar hosted by Haymarket Books. The webinar entitled A Global Green New Deal, Into the Portal, Leave No One Behind. It was hosted by Haymarket Books and it featured discussions by Arundhati Roy and Naomi Klein. Arundhati Roy is an Indian author best known for her novel, The God of Small Things, published in 1997, which won the Man Booker Prize for Fiction. She is also a political activist involved in human rights and environmental causes. She recently published an article entitled The Pandemic is a Portal, in which she discusses how COVID-19 threatens the world and what we should do next. Naomi Klein is a Canadian author, social activist, filmmaker, and professor. She is best known for her books No Logo in 1999, The Shock Doctrine in 2007, and This Changes Everything, Capitalism versus the Climate in 2014. The conversation, moderated by Asad Rehman, focused on how we move from crisis to justice and for a new world. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. The Taliban have completed their sweep of the south of Afghanistan. They took four more provincial capitals today in a lightning offensive that is gradually encircling Kabul, the capital. The Taliban now control 18 of the country's 34 provincial capitals. Seven have fallen in the last 24 hours, including Afghanistan's second and third largest cities, Kandahar to the south and Herat to the west. Thousands of Afghans have fled their homes amid fears the Taliban would again impose a brutal, repressive government, all but eliminating women's rights and conducting public executions. This woman who fled to Kabul described what happened to her family.
Taliban militants forcibly evicted me at gunpoint, killed my sons, and forcibly married my daughters-in-law. They forcibly took three or four girls from each house and married them. We had to leave.
Just weeks before the U.S. military is scheduled to complete its troop withdrawal from Afghanistan, the Pentagon is rushing 3,000 fresh troops to the Kabul airport to help with a partial evacuation of the U.S. embassy. Britain and Canada announced similar moves. A late-night announcement by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has authorized a booster dose of the Pfizer or Moderna COVID-19 vaccine for people with weakened immune systems. The announcement applies to the estimated 3% of the population which takes immune-suppressing medicines because of organ transplants, cancer, or others who are immunosuppressed. The decision does not apply to otherwise healthy individuals. Health authorities say they're closely monitoring if and when the general population will need a booster, but say for now the vaccines continue to be highly effective for most healthy people. The World Health Organization has urged wealthy nations not to give their general populations a third booster, while the world's poor continue to lack even a first dose of a vaccine. San Francisco has announced the toughest vaccination mandate in the nation. All patrons who want to enter indoor facilities like bars, restaurants, and gyms will have to show proof of full vaccination by August 20th. New York City's recently announced mandate requires proof of only a first dose. Christina Onnestad reports.
Mayor London Breed says city officials are upping the ante.
And starting August 20th, you will need proof of vaccination in businesses, for your customers in high contact areas, like bars, restaurants, clubs, theaters, entertainment venues, indoor gyms and fitness, and large indoor events with more than 1,000 people. By October 13th, employees at these establishments must be vaccinated as well.
The public health order also extends the vaccination requirement for certain health care providers, including employees at adult daycare centers, residential care facilities, dental offices, home health aides, and pharmacists. I'm Christina Onnested, reporting for KPFA.
New Orleans mayor yesterday announced a less stringent order. The city will require patrons of certain indoor businesses or sports venues to show proof of one vaccine dose or a negative coronavirus test within the last 72 hours. No racial or ethnic group forms the majority for people under the age of 18 in the newly released 2020 census figures. In the overall U.S. population, white people declined in numbers for the first time on record. Latino and Asian populations boomed last decade. Lily Bolke reports.
Nicholas Jones, Director of Race and Ethnic Research and Outreach for the U.S. Census Bureau, detailed data from the 2020 census, which show population growth in the last decade has largely been driven by increases in the number of Latino and Asian American residents.
The 2020 census results show that the U.S. population is much more multiracial and more racially and ethnically diverse than what we measured in the past.
The data is critical for redistricting, drawing new voting district maps for the next decade of elections. Katie Blair with the ACLU of Indiana says lines should be drawn to reflect changes in population and racial diversity, but contends when politicians draw the maps, they can dilute the voting power of the minority party or further marginalize communities of color.
By packing communities of color into too small of districts or by cracking communities of color and spreading them out over many districts.
I'm Lily Bolke for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Israel's new government is set to grant its first major approval of West Bank settlement construction. Israeli officials will also include a rare authorization of construction for Palestinian areas, according to an Israeli security official. The twin announcements appear to be aimed at bolstering the Palestinian Authority and also trying to blunt international opposition to Israeli settlement construction. The settlements are illegal under international law. I'm Eileen Alfandari for Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and those were our news headlines. Now, we turn our attention to the interrelationship between economic and environmental justice in the time of COVID-19. You will hear audio from a recent webinar hosted by Haymarket Books and featuring discussions by Arundhati Roy and Naomi Klein. During the first half of today's program, you will hear remarks from Arundhati Roy, who is an Indian author best known for her novel, The God of Small Things. She's also a political activist involved in human rights and environmental causes. She recently published an article entitled "The Pandemic is a Portal," in which she discusses how COVID-19 threatens the world and what kind of systemic changes are needed to solve poverty and environmental devastation. Let's hear now from Arundhati Roy.
I'll talk about things that I don't have answers for, but things that I'm thinking about and worrying about. You know, the coronavirus has perhaps obviously it's not the first pandemic in the world, the world has ever known, but perhaps the first pandemic in this WhatsAppized digital age. You know, where there's no interface between media anchors and every kind of virologist and epidemiologist and mathematical model maker, and so, you know, what is happening is in New York, and the way it's being dealt with in New York is within seconds being dealt with in India in the same way, the medical problems, the health issues, the strategic ways of dealing with that ought to be totally different, you know? So there's a kind of breakdown of the whole world that we've seen now. I mean, there is the machine of capitalism has come to a halt, and that is creating a kind of panic where there are people like us talking about one kind of way of looking at how to use this moment to bring people to their senses. And there's another situation in which the chessmen are being moved around so fast while we are all locked down. And I just wondered, you know, I just was reading about how they have, they're about to sign over a big elephant sanctuary with a lot of rare plants and rare birds in the state of Assam to coal mining. Coal mining has just been privatized. Everything is being privatized now to deal with this crisis. So exactly the opposite of what we want to happen is happening very fast. But when we talk about cherishing, and when we talk about passion, and when we talk about the people who have been affected, you know, for so many years here in India, there have been such great, ferocious, beautiful, militant movements, you know, raising all these issues with a different language, obviously, you know, because those movements have actually come from the ground, and they have said all the things that we're saying, which essentially, to put it in a sentence, was asking the world to redefine the meaning of progress, to redefine the meaning of civilization, to redefine the meaning of happiness. You know, do you really need to treat the earth like a resource in order to call yourself civilized? So we had a different idea of I mean, the people that were fighting had a different idea. But at the same time, you know, I think what really worries me is now that, let's say in the state of Assam, where the elephant sanctuary is going to be handed over to coal mining, it's a state where people have like since the 70s, you know, fought such, I mean, there's been such a huge movement there against what people think of as foreigners, you know, people who have come in from Bangladesh, whatever. It's a very vexed issue over there. It has been for a long time, and you can't just demonize what's going on. But that's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is the passions that kind of nationalistic identity arouses in people, that same passion doesn't translate onto the defense of the land, you know? So how do we make that so? How do we, as people who are thinking about how to mount this resistance, because ultimately we I think are at a stage where those who agree with us agree with us, and that includes a huge amount of young people. We're not going to be able to persuade the people in you know, the corporate CEOs or the fossil fuel industry. We're not going to be able to persuade them. We have to force them. We have to so we have to rally ourselves. And what are those pressure points, you know? Why have we, as I mean, my perspective and my understanding, of course, is pretty much rooted in this part of the world. And I keep thinking, you know, in the 60s, there were huge movements, ideological and revolutionary movements, demanding the redistribution of land, the redistribution of wealth, the call for revolution. And from the 60s to now, it became first a call for revolution, then it became just, you know, when the anti-dam movements and the anti-displacement movements started, just leave whatever little land people have, indigenous people or people who live on the riverbank, don't displace them. Let's just leave us with what little we have. And even that has been pushed back, you know. So we're left with a language of justice which has been reduced to talk of human rights. We are left with the language in which they adjudicate, you know. So I think we are in, I mean, the real crisis we face is how do we understand, but how do we mobilize and you know, how do we become militant about what we want and what we believe in? Because truly the next generation is going to be devastated. If people think coronavirus is a problem, it's a stuffed toy compared to the climate crisis that's coming. One of the ways in which what we are talking now of as climate change and about the climate crisis, one of the ways many years ago, 20 years ago, when people were fighting on the ground, of course they were not using these words, but they were fighting big dams, they were fighting mining, they were fighting deforestation, and they were, and where did the power of those fights come from? They came from the idea that people were being displaced in their hundreds of thousands, sometimes in their millions, you know, by these big projects, which were then directly, you could see people being pushed off their lands and forced into big cities. So, you know, the non-Hindu fascist government, the pro-neoliberal Congress government had a vision where they wanted India to be urbanized. They wanted like 70% of the, you know, it used to be 80% rural, 20% urban. And there was this a push of people to be now arriving as pools of cheap labor in cities, hidden in these tenements and working as more or less slave labor in the garment industry and the construction. And now, when Modi announced the lockdown, 1.38 billion of us were locked down with 4 hours notice. So all the world has seen the pictures of the exodus of millions of stranded workers. They are now those same people who were pushed out of their villages by these projects, which are exactly what we are opposing now, moved into the cities. And now there's this massive reverse migration because they do not exist in the imagination of this country anymore. The poor were simply erased. They were erased in literature. They were erased in cinema. They were erased in politics, except when you start looking at voter booth counts and all that. And suddenly they reappeared now. And what we are witnessing every day here is millions of people walking hundreds of kilometers, hungry, without water, without food, without money. And the answer to this is more privatization, more mining, more deforestation. Why? Because this is how you're going to power back the economy, you know. So we don't even know what the contours this. We roughly know the contours of the crisis. We don't know the horror. We don't know the texture of it. We don't know the depth of it. But the chaos is on the level, honestly, of some kind of crime against humanity. I mean, sometimes I think you really need the COVID trials, you know, to tell us what are these structural things that are going on while this. I keep using the word biblical, but the Bible has not seen such numbers, you know, this kind of, you know, even the people who are closed in their homes, I don't think, and sleep at night thinking, what have we done? Who are we? You know, and combine that with the Hindu fascist Islamophobia, the detention centers being built, the Muslim, anti-Muslim citizenship law. So, and you have, while these millions of people have no transport, no way to get home hundreds of miles away, you have the Indians who were stranded abroad being, you know, flown back in sanitized planes, almost as though preparations are being made to separate the working classes from the flying classes forever, like a class apartheid, you know? We had a caste apartheid, we have a religious apartheid, and now a class apartheid, where you have this touchless future, you know? And what's going to happen to the bulk of the workers of the world? You know, some of them will continue to work, of course, but the interface between the you know, the flying classes will actually be hermetically sealed, you know. So I used to say that you had the India's middle and upper classes have fought the most successful secessionist struggle in the world, where they've seceded into outer space, and they look down and say, what's our coal doing in your fields, and what's our water doing in your rivers, and what's our timber doing in your forest? But now that's, you know, so you can't really think of countries anymore. You think of elites and then another world, and COVID is making it really a hermetically sealed. The main thing is really to change our imagination. I mean, when I come to Europe and the US, when I travel there, I do feel very, I mean, people keep asking me, you know, why do you live in India? This is so much horror. But there's also a wilderness of the imagination here still. There's also places where the possibility of a different way of living and a different way of thinking and a different way of understanding what civilization could be still exists really, I mean, in reality. It's something that I wrote in one of the essays a while ago. I was traveling in the state of Orissa, where, you know, there's a lot of bauxite, and there's a lot of bauxite mining. So the bauxite mountains are these porous rock mountains, you know, flat mountains, which for the people around, they function as water tanks. Bauxite holds the water, and then it waters the plains below, very fertile plains, you know. And then you have these mining companies who are, for whom the bauxite in the mountain means nothing. It's only valuable when you take it out of the mountain. Whereas for the people there, it's only valuable when it's in the mountain, doing what it's meant to do in nature, you know. So I thought, when will we be able to have an imagination that allows you to leave the bauxite in the mountain, you know? Because that is the beginning of a domino effect. Once you understand that you just can't extract everything, that things are finite, then your genius, there is no doubt that the human race is a genius race, but your genius moves towards thinking differently, not thinking of the bauxite out of the mountain, but the bauxite in the mountain. Then you move towards respecting the land. What is it that grows on this land that nourishes the people here? Not what cash crop can I grow and send to Canada, you know? Can you look at the food on your plate and not have frequent flyer miles on it, you know? Can it just be, because that's how people like me did grow up, you know? I mean, when I grew up in Kerala, everything on my plate was really literally from within a 1 kilometer radius, you know? Whether it was the fish or the rice or the bamboo pole you caught, it was, and it was fine. No one was suffering, you know? So a different imagination, going through the portal would be to say that, you know, change doesn't mean you're going to necessarily suffer. It could be so much more beautiful, you know, to be in a place where you respect, you don't have a psychotic relationship with the earth that you want to despoil it and destroy it, but, and to your fellow human beings too. It's a great relief. It's a great relief to respect the earth and to have a more equal relationship with people. And for this, I just want to say that, you know, we do know that our enemies are on the right and they are the CEOs and so on. But also, I mean, speaking from my experience in India, The left has by the left, I mean, in India, the left isn't the American left. It's a regular, real communist left, or it considers itself to be. But it has also failed. It has also failed to understand what women want. It has failed to understand caste. It has failed to understand the environment in so many ways. And so you do need a new and more wholesome ideological approach to carry. Why did Bernie eventually not get nominated? You know, it wasn't only because of the neoliberal Democrats. You know, he also didn't carry, I think, a lot of people, a lot of African Americans, you know, who feel left out of the conversation. In some ways, we have to include everybody in this understanding of what justice looks like. Only then the siloization, those walls will break down. You know, only when you can't just get away by saying caste is class, comrade. It's not. It's more than that, you know. So I think we have a lot of work, I mean, to understand how to build solidarities on our side also, you know. It's not just because the other side is never going to be with us. I mean, we don't have to waste too much time trying to convince them. It's about rallying those who understand and agree but have to feel the passion for each other, you know. You know, how do people who are just fighting for their lives, fighting to survive, how do you, I mean, some of them are not fighting because of a climate crisis. You know, they are fighting because of a hatred crisis or a hunger crisis. Mm-hmm. It's hard to try and rally all these things and explain all these things as part of one thing, though it is one thing, mm-hmm. you know, but the desperation is so extreme, the violence is so extreme, the oppression is so extreme, the threat of, you know, being picked up and put into jails where corona is spreading is happening to people now. Although I think it's so important to keep doing what Naomi, what you do, which is to forefront the connections between all of this, because that's what you can do best as a writer, you know. But at the same time, you know, sometimes you just feel like you're surrounded by fire, you know, mm-hmm. by fire, and even you know. People who say anything, the threat is so imminent and so terrifying in some ways.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take a quick station break. When we return, we'll continue with this special on the interrelationship between economic and environmental justice in the time of COVID-19. You're going to want to stay with us. Naomi Klein is coming up. We'll be right back.
Paul and Silas, bound in jail, had no money for to go their bail. Keep your eyes on the prize, hold on, hold on, hold on, hold on, hold on. Keep your eyes on the prize, hold on, hold on. Paul and Silas begin to shout, then door open and then walk down. Right. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on, hold on, hold on, hold on, hold on. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on, hold on.
Welcome back to Sojourner Truth. Check us out on our website at sotrueradio.org. If you're on Facebook, you can look for us and like us there. We're also on SoundCloud. And today, we're on SoundCloud nationally and internationally. And today we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the Bronx and New York City. That is the Bronx, New York City. And internationally, we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Canada. Now we return to the special on the interrelationship between economic and environmental justice in the time of COVID-19. You'll be hearing more audio from a recent webinar entitled A Global Green New Deal, Into the Portal, Leave No One Behind. It was hosted by Haymarket Books. The webinar featured talks by Arundhati Roy and Naomi Klein, authors and activists who are known around the world. During the second half of today's program, you will hear from Naomi Klein. Naomi Klein is a Canadian author, social activist, filmmaker, and professor. She is best known for her books, No Logo, The Shock Doctrine, and This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. Let us hear from her now.
I'm really moved by the number of people who have tuned in and wanted to be part of this. And I really want to stress that even though we've all done lots of webinars and teach-ins, we're trying to do something a little bit different here. This is an invitation to be part of a process. And originally, there was going to be a big in-person gathering in London. We had an incredible lineup of speakers, and I'm not going to list them all because it's just going to make us sad that we didn't get to be together. But it grew out of a critique, I think quite a legitimate critique, of the conversations that were happening about various Green New Deals in the UK and in the US and in Canada, where this idea that actually came from the Global South. When I wrote This Changes Everything, I began with a quote from Angelica Navarro, Bolivia's then one of Bolivia's climate negotiators, calling for a Marshall Plan for planet Earth, a redistribution of resources on a scale never seen before, recognizing the debt that was owed from the North to the South, and really seizing on the climate crisis and the fact that we can quantify who warmed this planet, because we know where the carbon came from over several hundred years, as an invitation to build a more just world, or to set the world right side up, as the late great author Eduardo Galeano might have told us in a moment like this. And yet, despite these roots and groundwork laid by organizations like Acción Ecológica, who were going to be participating in the Global Green New Deal gathering, in some ways, the Global South had dropped off the radar of many of the people talking about a Green New Deal in the North. So on the one hand, we saw progress being made because we weren't talking about a narrow carbon-based climate policy that was just about having cap and trade or something like that. And it was talking about industrial policy and really the next economy we want. We were hearing all kinds of nationalist framings creep in, like we need, economic patriotism, and we're gonna win the race with China in green tech and things like that. And then we'll dump a whole bunch of cheap solar panels on the Global South and call it justice. And it really wasn't reckoning some of this with the logics of growth and endless so-called progress. And so the idea around this gathering, this process, was to begin to have a more participatory, a more democratic conversation that included many more voices from the Global South. And so that process has now moved online. But I really want to urge those of you who are tuning in today to not be only spectators to this process, but really to plug in, to follow the links. On Twitter, we've got the Global GN Deal handle, where you can follow this or follow War on One or The Leap. just to stay involved, because we're going to try to do digitally some of what we were going to be doing in person. That was going to be happening anyway in parallel. And of course, there will come a time when we'll be able to gather again in person in our communities to feed into a global process. And there's an in-person conference is always going to be limited anyway. So maybe we'll end up with a process that is more decentralized and more inclusive anyway. So that's where what this comes out of. And I think where we are, you know, in answering and trying to begin to answer this challenge, which I don't feel like I can or anyone can really, what is the system that needs changing? It goes by, you know, we all know the names, right? We are talking about the violence of a capitalist system. We are talking about an extractivist logic that treats both the earth itself, individual places, and entire groups of people as disposable. So it's a logic of endless extraction and disposal that really cherishes nothing and no one. And at The Leap, we talk about moving from that logic to a logic of care and repair, caring for the earth and one another, right? These are slogans. These are, you know, little catchphrases. But one of the things that I think is really striking about the moment that we're in right now with this pandemic is, you know, the roar of workers who are on the front lines, who are talking about being simultaneously essential and disposable, or simultaneously essential and sacrificial, right? And so if we think about that arc of history and the fissures and injustices that created this crisis and the climate crisis itself, it was always built on the idea of essential and the simultaneity of the essential and the sacrificial, right? If we think about the earliest inputs to the colonial project, stolen land and stolen bodies of African slaves, of indigenous land, the essential was always treated as sacrificial. Its essentialness was always denied, right? So I think that cuts very deep into what it is that needs changing, the sickness of the system, and maybe hints at the world that we need to build that is founded in treating no one as if they are sacrificable and nowhere, right? It begins with cherishing and builds from there. And I think that we are in a malleable moment, right? Where, you know, whenever we have these moments and we seem to have them more frequently, where capitalism is just wildly breaking its own rules in broad daylight, right? We saw it after the 2008 financial crisis, and we are now seeing it again. That creates an opening, but the opening is brief, right? Where if we have the confidence, and, you know, coming to that Milton Friedman quote, right, only a crisis, real or perceived, produces real change. It's interesting that I think that Friedman's fascination and actually fear of moments of crisis was built on an understanding that previous profound economic crises, in particular the market crash of 1929, had produced everything that he hated about redistribution of wealth in his own country, right? It produced the New Deal. And if we understand neoliberalism really as a class war to dismantle the gains of working people in the aftermath of the, in the midst of the Great Depression, in the aftermath of the Second World War, it explains the shock doctrine. The shock doctrine is a way of preventing moments of crisis from being seized by regular people, by working people, to demand real fixes to what those crises reveal, to the unveilings. And you know, I often think in this moment of friends that I met in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria, who talk about Hurricane Maria as an unveiling all of these pre-existing crises and vulnerabilities, including, you know, Arundhati was talking about an imagination that allowed for thinking that we could be happy with food that we had grown ourselves, grown locally. These shocks to our system produce the realization of just how vulnerable we are because of the logics of capitalist globalization, which creates these incredibly long supply chains that are highly centralized, highly, you know, so for Puerto Rico, all of their food was coming, you know, almost all, around 90, more than 90% of the food in to an island or an archipelago of islands that were incredibly fertile was being imported through a single port, much of it coming from a single port in Florida, and both those ports were hit by two different hurricanes, right? So, you know, we talk about food and food security, and that can seem like jargon and abstraction until the moment that your port where all your food is coming through gets knocked out, or the electricity that is coming from centralized sources gets knocked out. And so these alternatives that have been kept alive in large part by indigenous movements around the world, saving seeds, saving knowledge, protecting ways of living with the earth that were much less vulnerable to being knocked out in a moment, now don't, you know, look like a, you know, just a sort of a silly old-fashioned way of living, but actually a much more much more intelligent way of surviving a future that is going to be marked by many more shocks, right? So when we talk about the portal, right, I mean, we're not talking about a sunny utopia, right? Like, we're talking about how we survive a future that is going to have many more of these of this staccato shocks before the last one was in any way resolved, and we're seeing it right now. We're entering into hurricane season. We will still be in a pandemic when those hurricanes start pummeling island nations, start pummeling coastal cities. So how are we going to live together, right? What is going to allow us to hold on to our humanity, to not lock down, to not fear strangers? And I think we need to be building in, you know, I sometimes talk about shock absorbers, but it's really about resisting the logic of that brutal efficiency that doesn't leave any slack in the system, right? So every time there's any kind of hit, you know, there's no beds in the hospital, there's no food, there's no food reserves, there's no water, right? Because the logic of capitalist efficiency makes sure that there's no slack in the system. So we need a much more bountiful logic, because that's actually what's going to allow us to survive. And we need that when it comes to food. We need redundancies, right? Nature has all of these brilliant redundancies built in because we know that there are shocks. But capitalism has been taking out all the redundancies so that we are so vulnerable every time we have one of these shocks. I just want to, you know, one of the reasons why I find the metaphor of the portal so important, right, is that it is a reminder that we are going somewhere different, right? That does by no means necessarily means it's better. And I think we all agree that it's more likely to be worse, right? But what we aren't doing is going back to where we were before. Like, we are in a period of seismic shift. And I think one of the things that is potentially radicalizing in a good way about this moment, you know, Arundhati was talking about the rich, you know, declaring independence really from the rest of the world, and living a kind of a hermetically sealed luxury existence, right? I mean, I don't think it can ever be hermetically sealed, because there will always be hands that pack the boxes, that do the, that pick the food. That is not going to be automated. But what capitalism will be better at doing is hiding the hands. Yes. Right? So we're actually in a moment where the two worlds are butting up against each other in a more closely, and with more porousness we are seeing each other, like because of this unveiling, to mix metaphors, right? We are seeing and thinking about the hands that make our lives possible, we who are part of the lockdown class. And so, you know, just to finish this thought, right, how do we maintain that? Because what Silicon Valley is in the midst of doing is figuring out very, very quickly how to hide the hands, right? What they're repackaging so-called frictionless technologies or seamless technologies as now touchless technologies, right? So you're going to get your Amazon packages by drone and or driverless vehicle, and they're going to, you know, they're talking about how they're eliminating touch points in all of this. And so there's a massive rebranding campaign. I'm calling it the Screen New Deal. But it's all an illusion, because all it is about is hiding the hands and the touch that we will never be able be freed from, right? And so in this moment where we're recognizing the pandemic as a crisis, you know, down the road, it could just be that we're just like, find a way to live with 3,000 people a day dying in the United States from the pandemic, and that just gets normalized. Now we're calling that a crisis. This is a moment that we have to build upon, right? Where this is a moment where, like, the front page of the New York Times is, you know, featuring a corpse with a gloved hand, you know, performing last rites. And then there's a new section of the New York Times on Sundays called At Home, How We Live Now. And it's all about, you know, quarantine lifestyle, sourdough recipes, camping with your kids in the backyard, how to have a staycation, wonderful things you can get ordered to your home, what to watch on streaming video, right? So it's already turning the pandemic into a luxury lifestyle, right? Right? And those hands, and I'm borrowing a lot of this from my partner, Abby Lewis, and, you know, and we're all building on work that lots of people are doing, and our mutual friend V. Venzler has been writing about the, you know, the way in which touch is being disappeared. But how do we, I feel like our political task now is to not let the hands disappear and to keep open the spaces where we see through these portals, right? Before everybody, all of it gets disappeared. We are in this strange moment where the forces of the far right, the forces of fascism, are more internationalist than than the left. You know, because I think because of the failures of our attempts, of our more recent attempts at internationalism, and it's not to say that there aren't some doorways that have always stayed open, but we have to remember that Trump and Modi and Netanyahu and Viktor Orban and Scott Morrison, I mean, they're all trading tricks, you know, and technologies, right? And you know, the conversations that I've had with you in recent years, Arundhati, about this have been very harrowing for me, because I do believe that there's a lot. I think that we see a migration of tactics. You know, where Israel has been using Palestinians as a laboratory for a lot of these surveillance technologies that then get sold and repackaged. I think China has been a laboratory for controls of information and ways of having a high-tech state while still having a controlled population. What happened, I think, in India after Modi's re-election and the sort of gloves-off ferociousness and the use of technology as a disciplining tool, unplugging and plugging people in, right? It's very important that we have these exchanges, right? And we need to do a better job, I think, of having more of them, because you know, we're all offering each other previews and of what's to come. We need to learn about resistance strategies that have worked, that have failed. So we can't give up on internationalism, and I don't think anybody is suggesting that. We need more of it. And I just want to stress again to those listening that this isn't just a teach-in. It's also a process that we really want your experiences and wisdom to feed into, because we know how much we're leaving out. One thing I just want to stress is I think that, because we have gone into, you know, those fires that Arundhati is describing, and it is a really frightening moment, and we are committed to not spreading false hope. We have to be very honest about the challenges that we face and the stakes of this moment. But I do think that the kind of courage that we are seeing from the people who are really in the fire, whether, you know, who are being actively sacrificed in this moment, sent, you know, to treat people without masks, without protective, basic protective equipment, because we don't respect women's care work, whether they're home care workers, whether they're working in nursing homes, you know, whether they're working in hospitals. You know, in so many ways, I think this virus has acted like a kind of a heat-seeking missile that finds wherever people are being treated as refuse, as disposable, with lack of respect, wherever living beings are being treated that way. That's where we're seeing the outbreaks, right? In the slaughterhouses, in the old age homes, where our elders are being treated with such little respect, where the people who care for them are treated with such little respect, right? And so I think the pain and the complexity of this moment is that on the one hand, we see the system that just unveiled, and the lack of care and the extreme racism and sexism in who is treated as disposable. But we are also seeing these outpourings of love and appreciation for the laborers who are keeping us alive and caring for us and caring for our loved ones when we can't be with them. And so I think we need to build on that, and we need, in very concrete terms, to stand with the people who are taking extreme risks in this moment, who are saying we will refuse to be simultaneously essential and disposable, right? And we are seeing these walkouts by Amazon workers and nurses, you know, demonstrating outside of hospitals. And so what is the duty? You know, I did an event recently with Eric Ward from the Southern Poverty Law Center, and he said the only question that matters now is, are liberals going to stand with workers or with capital? And I think, I don't know exactly where we are going through the portal, but I do firmly believe that it begins, if we don't want it to end up in that dystopia that we've seen in every, you know, sci-fi, bad sci-fi movie, that it begins with those of us who have the luxury of being offered this actually dystopian, touchless life, to first of all reject it, say we hate it, that the Silicon Valley utopia is actually a dystopia, and to take real risks to stand with the people who are making our lives possible. Whether concretely, you know, boycotting the employers that are treating them as sacrificable, you know, and also fighting for the policies that are the difference between life and death, whether that means canceling rent, erasing medical debt, fighting for universal health care, and all of this is building towards, you know, the vision of a true global Green New Deal.
We're out of time. I'd like to thank all of the panelists today, and a special thanks to Haymarket Books for granting us permission to share this audio with our audience. I would like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, Romero Funes, our assistant producer, and today's audio engineer. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Y'all stay safe. Thank you.
90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.